another episode of Reads of the Week by DH Radio. Joining me today is my colleague L. Subramani. Hi sir, how are you? How are you doing?
I am really fine. Thank you very much once again for having called me as part of this conversation. I hear that Bangalore is unusually hot.
Oh yes, yes, it is. Oh God, I look toasted, sir. Like I've just gone out today for a movie review and then I came back. I feel almost toasted because I wear those sort of beach sort of slippers. So right. I was late, so I just took them off wearing outside without applying any cream or anything like that. And then when I came back and removed the slippers, the I could see the color differentiation on both sides.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I think the only missing thing on you is probably a straw hat or something. That would
In a hurry, I just went out and I came back almost baked. How's it in Chennai?
No, Chennai is if you call Bangalore hot, you can call Chennai infernal. Chennai lives up to the reputation, and if I'm not sweating, it's because I've turned on the air condition. Otherwise, it would be quite an effort to sort of sit in a place, even under the shade. See, the difference between Chennai and Bangalore, I feel, is that if you're in the shade in Bangalore, if you're indoors in Bangalore, at least you don't sweat. You can make do with a fan. But that's not the case in Chennai. Probably that's because it's a sea-facing city. The humidity levels are pretty high, and it can be energy sapping sometimes. And that's why, as you can see, I've got a bottle of water in front of me. And, I make sure that I take a sip from it every now and then.
That's where you need to be hydrated in this time. Because I remember, like, just a few days ago in Bangalore, even on social media, you could see people posting these pictures of tabebuyas in full bloom. You know, some people comparing it with Japan's cherry blossom trees. The city was colorful. Okay, that was just for a few days. Now it is burning. It's literally burning. And even
it comes to life when you say, summer. I think the time you say summer and then you turn back, it's kind of gone from a tolerable level of warmth to unbearable heat. I think
And partly to blame is also the climate change, because I haven't seen Bangalore this hot when I was like a little kid. I mean, it's totally different.
I know. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Lots of people tell me that. You know. See, I am a relatively newcomer to Bangalore. I moved in 2004, and even back then it wasn't this bad.
You know how much I love food and everything. So I've got my drink set right. So I have some lychee juice with me. So I've kept that ready, just a squash, lychee squash mixed with water and cool, chilled it. So keep myself hydrated with that. So. What about, I think the best, during these times is the lemonade. Like, what do you think?
I think lemonade is probably the easiest to prepare. And I was reading somewhere that lemon has the ability to, energize your brain. So if you feel sleepy and especially, at work, having a lemonade without any salt or even without sugar, it's actually very good for your body. It not only hydrates, it also energizes you a lot.
That's why no wonder we have like lemon tea at all. I miss that.
Oh yeah, lots of office we miss. You know, this lockdown has deprived us of a lot of office fun together.
That's goodies, I say.
And also things like the stuff that we get from the vending machines
there. yeah
and then you have the lemon tea, as you rightly said, and and also the a lot of stuff about bantering and the coolness we feel in the fully air-conditioned office space. We're missing a lot of community, I guess. That's what this lockdown has robbed us of.
Maybe in a few more months, I think we'll be back. Hopefully we'll be back and we can relish those. But at that time, it will be even better because if it's a few more months, I think there'll be monsoon, and then you can yes. you know, have like a nice hot tea with hopefully they yes. make pakoras for us in office
as a
welcome back.
as a sort of an on the house, you know, welcome, you know, a snack or of some kind. No, actually, I like Bangalore actually better during the monsoon, especially
yeah.
during the beginning of the monsoon, when you know you have the rain clouds and mm-hmm. you know, the sudden burst of rain.
Yeah,
of course, it's a nuisance if you are going to start for office at that time. But I would say that weather-wise, it is so lovely to be. Mm. Seeing the rain.
It is, and most importantly, what monsoon you know brings to mind, and what happens during monsoon is that it's a romantic time, right? Don't you think so?
It is really romantic, and like summer, I think monsoon also kind of gets you to a set of books that you might like to read, probably at you know, during those rainy days when probably, you know, you have the luxury of a day off, and you know, you have no other you know, urgent work to worry about. Monsoon is a pretty fantastic time. It's I like the rain. The steady patter of it, the noises that you to hear, you know,
the smell of the earth,
the smell of the earth, and even you know, sometimes you get this kind of birds, a kind of you can see that they're a little more animated, as if they're also welcoming the weather, you know. So I think it's a very good time in Bangalore.
Yeah, and you know, as we've chatted along, right, we've mentioned two of the books that you have read, both one romantic and another one has lemonade in its title. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. I will definitely start with the lemonade book. And the lemonade book is basically, as I told you, it is a kind of a subject that we don't normally get to see or hear, even in these days of Me Too movement and, you know, this girl power and the spirit of, you know, women. The reason I say that is because it is a subject that women find it pretty shy to even talk to among their own family members, you know, and the subject is fertility or infertility. You know, Ahmed, it is the quirkiness of our society is such that, you know, if a couple gets married, the first thing that they ask, you know, after the first month, hopefully, is that, you know, are you going to have a kid?
Kid, yeah. You know? Yeah.
And it is basically that I would say that's the kind of a mindset that that exists for generations in our society. And if there is an infertility issue, if there is a lack of childbirth, and the blame is kind of immediately fixed on a woman. You know, a man is not to be suspected of not being potent enough to bear or produce a child. It's always the woman. But when you look at it scientifically, it is quite possible that, you know, in spite of the fact that both the man and the woman are perfectly capable or physically all right in terms of producing a kid, there could be a lot of other issues on the way. Maybe stress, maybe the work schedule, maybe, you know, they are not doing the things at the right time. You know, there are lots of reasons we were not aware of. Thankfully, today we have fertility clinics everywhere, and you have doctors medically assisting couples to sort of have children. But that's what I was talking about. That's not the subject that you kind of normally sit down and hear, even in a family environment, because maybe, you know, it is still not considered a nice thing for a couple to sort of have a medically assisted pregnancy. You know, it's sort of considered unnatural, or maybe it's not looked upon as something
it's
as
sort of
normal.
Still a taboo, and people don't look at it as like a medical procedure or a regular medical procedure. It's something, oh no, It's just like keeping an one arm distance or just, you know, brushing it under the carpet.
Exactly. That's the kind of a tendency that you have. And, you know, basically when even when a relative, you know, asks you, you know, these days, I think this book, according to this book, and I think I've also seen it in some places that, you know, are you taking fertility treatment? That's one question that kind of comes very, very frequently, you know, especially when you confront a couple that never had, you know, produced a child for about 2 or 3 years. And, you know, everybody knows about fertility clinics, which is probably, you know, something that's good. But what's not so good is, you know, the fact that we're not having a proper understanding of the subject. We're not putting the couple at ease. We're not giving women the space and the opportunity to talk about fertility, especially in medically assisted fertility. And that's what this book does. And this book, as titled, is What's the Lemon Squeezer Doing in My Vagina? Very bold, very curious title. Something that you might like to pick up when you see it on the bookshelf at your neighborhood bookshop. And probably, you know, if you are still very conventional, you would give a furtive look around to check if nobody's watching you. I don't know if you still do such things. But yeah, but that's a kind of a book it is, because it makes you curious, instantly very curious. Okay, now when you pick up the book and read, I wouldn't say that this book is a sort of an education or educational kind of a manual, or you know, this is going to give you the A to Z of how to get pregnant. You know, this is not a how-to book, or this is not a DIY manual. If any of these were to be true, I think this book would have failed to get any attention, because, you know, we have humpteen books with those droning academic tone talking about, you know, what is IUI or IVF and some such things. On the contrary, this book, you know, deals with the subject with a lot of emotion, a lot of, you know, sensitivity. And at the same time, it tells you a story. Stephen King says that, you know, you read a story, you read a book, but not because it's a literary classic, or, you know, it is out of the world, original voice, memoir with so much information. Those are secondary. You know, if you're a regular reader, I'm talking about the regular readers. I'm not talking about those who sort of flaunt readership as a sort of a quality that they might like others to envy about. Those are not the kind of people that I'm talking about. I'm talking about people who, like you and me, who like you know, to read and just get dissolved in an emotional experience, in an experience that is that is sort of emotionally rewarding. That's what this book is all about, and that's why, you know, I have nothing but high praise for Rohini S. Rajagopal, who is the author of this book. And you know, I should also, you know, we should applaud people like her for the courage to talk about pain. Because courage to talk about pain is not something that happens so easily in our society. You know, we are kind of a society who would like to go on Facebook and you know, keep putting those positive messages and then, you know, put out this face to the outside world that, you know, we are fine. You know, we are doing well. But inside, emotionally, we may be struggling and we need help. And that's not something that we would very often talk about, you know. But that's the kind of world. But, you know, Rohini has sort of defied that sort of a pattern. And then she has come out and she has spoken about a rarely discussed subject. And, of course, a subject whose emotional intensity is not very often appreciated. You don't very often talk about fertility in terms of pain, challenge, struggle, to the extent that it could be emotionally disintegrating for a woman. I'll give you an example, you know. See, it's very simple. Okay, the story is very simple. As I'm talking about, you know, you kind of know what the story is all about, right? So this lady, you know, this woman, you know, who's actually from Trivandrum, has a single-minded, goal-oriented attitude about her. I mean, she sets her mind on something. When it comes to education, when it comes to job, she exactly knows what she wants, and she very often, or probably almost every time, she achieves it. And you know, okay, she's very interestingly talking about the way she met her husband, and you know, how their marriage happened. But once that happens, she comes to Bangalore. She settles down in a very bustling metropolis. You know, there's for a few years at least, there's the expectation that the pregnancy is going to happen by itself. And then, you know, when time keeps going and the stuff isn't happening, that's when it becomes an obsession. You know, it's a kind of a blip in an otherwise perfect life, you know, good childhood, good grades, good college, good, you know, workplace. Okay, although probably with a little more struggle, and a good married life. So it's sort of automatic, you know, progressing to motherhood or progressing to parenthood is sort of considered very automatic. But that wasn't the case with Rohini. And what she does is, you know, she slowly and hesitantly opens up to the idea of approaching the fertility clinic. And probably, you know, it's not because there is an expectation. There's often the painful questioning from, you know, her close family and relatives. Okay, what's happening? You're going to have a child, kind of questions. You know, those things are getting asked every time. It's not just that. It's not even the fact that, you know, probably every peer of hers, every friend of hers, every colleague of hers is kind of turning up with pregnancy one day or the other. It's not even that. It's not even peer pressure. It's mostly that something that she wanted for herself very badly. And that's how the story starts. So this is basically, she wants to be pregnant because it's something that she wants to experience, you know. And as she very nicely puts it, when everything else about life is good, you get obsessed about that one thing that's not happening. It's like it turns into an obsession, probably a little unhealthy, but you know, you want to have it at any cost. You're young, you know, you're at the right age. And you know, she's also kind of ominously noting the fact that she's crossing the age where you know, safe pregnancy, you know, pregnancy could be, you know, a sort of a little concern, because, you know, any pregnancy related, you know, any pregnancies happening after 35 will be a little bit of a challenge for the mother and the baby. So with all that, she approaches the fertility clinic, and then, you know, the first thing that's recommended of her is the IUI, intrauterine insemination, IUI. And the IUI is basically close to the normal pregnancy, because they make things happen inside the person's body. Nothing is outside of it. But again, it has to work. It has to work by itself, you know. And when it fails to work, when all the, you know, the medical procedures that she goes through, when everything else fails, again, she has to resort to IVF, which is not only cumbersome and, you know, emotionally challenging, as I mentioned earlier, but also very expensive for a normal family. I mean, she says it could be about one and a half lakhs, one cycle, that is. So, I mean, this is again, you know, a rough estimate that she gives.
That's a massive amount. It's,
yes.
For yes, those who are not able to afford it, it's very, very difficult.
It is very, very difficult. And also, imagine, you know, you keep failing after each cycle.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So what happens is they kind of induce the body, the woman's body, to produce more eggs, and then they will create the small embryos outside and then freeze them. And with every cycle, they put insert one embryo after the other. If an embryo kind of latches on and sort of develops into a baby or a fetus, then it's considered successful. Although this sounds very straightforward, when I read this book, it was very scary because there were times when, you know, it seemed like, you know, she had conceived. Because there was a heartbeat, there was a certain other parameter that wasn't consistent with the pregnancy, and then it turns out that it was some kind of a failed pregnancy of some kind. So these are basically very emotionally challenging for a woman who is kind of very badly wanting to have a child. After the third attempt is when it succeeds for her. She succeeds in the third attempt. But by then, you know, every time there's a glimmer of hope, you know, she kind of feels that it's going to happen. You know, there's this eager anticipation. And then there is a crash. There's a crushing blow that, you know, it's failed this time again. And you can't tell this outside. As we were talking earlier, this is still not a very easy subject to talk about, not even to your own in-laws or parents or brothers or sisters. It's not an easy thing to talk. Mm-hmm. And imagine, a girl who is going through this with her husband for support. The only people who are involved were, you know, Rohini and her husband, Ranjit, you know. So it is a kind of struggle that a woman has to go through. And it's a sad thing that there is no understanding of the emotional challenges involved in artificial pregnancies. That's what this book is going on to break. What I like about this book again is that, you know, it feels as if there's a person who is just sitting opposite from across the table and then talking to, you know, someone who is going through the same experience or someone who is considering approaching a fertility clinic about the emotional challenges, about the struggles. And probably also empowering that person to sort of go through it with courage. I think that's what is very interesting about this book. And this book tells it like a story. Mm-hmm. So you would like to, you know, you would like to go through it. You'd like to read and then, you know, kind of understand. You know, mm-hmm. And there are not that everything she does is correct also. In many ways, you know, for example, she over Googles. You know, she herself says, you know, when the third pregnancy happens, I mean, she kind of expects the child to be of a certain weight or a certain level of growth, which you know, you Google it and it says it has to be at a certain level of growth. But the real measurements that she has from the clinic is not consistent with that. So she thinks that, okay, this is going to be another false pregnancy. But the doctors were pretty sure. They say that you just wait and watch. Just wait and watch. And then it turns out to be, you know, quite unlike what she read in the Google kind of results that Google spewed out, you know.
Yeah.
So over-researching is also not good. And
it's just like a coping mechanism, I feel, because of your anxieties. Like you just want some sort of... assertion and,
Yeah, you want to know everything. You want to know why certain things are happening. And then so the best thing, of course, these days is to sort of go to, you know, Google and then, you know, get the information. But what she cautions people is that you can get the information, but only the qualified doctor can interpret the information correctly for you. And they have something that you and I don't have, which is experience. I mean, which is not just for fertility. I think it is true for many, many things, you know. These days, you know, we have this tendency to sort of Google and then, you know, ask a lot of questions to the doctors, which is at one level, it is good. But there's another level where probably we are sort of understanding the fact that, you know, we're not qualified to interpret a lot of the information that's available out there, you know. So I feel that these are cautionary tales that is coming out of a book like this, especially when it reads like a story. It reads like when you go through that person's emotional roller coaster. and sort of look at the whole thing from you know, an experiential point of view, you understand that okay, we got to be prepared for emotionally for the challenges of artificial and medically assisted fertilization, but at the same time you also know what not to do. So that's why this book is good, and this came out on Women's International Women's Day. And oh, as we were discussing the other day, you know, there are a lot of people who keep asking, why should we have a international, you know, Women's Day? You know, every day is Women's Day because, you know, women are the ones who kind of run a lot of things. You know, they are the shakers and movers of the society. I tend to agree with it. But also, there are issues that are very unique to women that probably that are not getting discussed as much as we would like. And one of the issues is fertility, infertility, artificially assisted, medically assisted fertilization, and things like that. And today, if you look at it, there are a lot of fertility clinics that are advertising from tier 2 cities. And exactly, it's not just the urban, you know, the cosmopolitan urban couple who are having fertility issues. The fertility issues just go beyond urban spaces into rural and semi-rural areas. So today the issue is much wider, and therefore the understanding of it needs to be much better. That's where this book comes in handy. And I only feel that, you know, people who read this, by the way, you can read it, you know, as a book, as an experience, as a memoir, you know, without having to, you know, worry about whether somebody, you know, must read this as an educational material. As I said, it's a book. It tells a story, and anybody can read it from that sense. But if you read that, you would get sensitized to the whole subject, and probably that's what the people should do. You know, reading books like this would sensitize them to the issue itself.
If you'd remember, like maybe around 50, 60 years ago, like a long time ago, when you would have any disease and the fact of approaching a doctor was itself, you know, a big thing, right, for people. And even now, for certain diseases like cancer or, I mean, for example, cancer itself, a lot many people are very hesitant to go to doctors. But then that is changing. But here, there's a unique situation that it is related to a subject which is in itself is considered a taboo in India. That is sex, right? It comes down to that. Yeah. And then you have like issues relating to this. So we can really understand. And being a woman in that position is a very difficult task, because everybody would, you know, judge you. Everybody would you know, pass comments, and there'll be so many. It's very difficult. And I think
the thing also, you know, for example, you know, you meet a person. She has described it in this book. You meet a person who is not well known to you. You know, you happen to just meet them because they kind of they've kind of come to the same function, or probably they're, you know, kind of a very distant relative of yours. And then you know, they talk about you know, childbirth, family, raising a family, and so on and so forth. And then, you know, suddenly out of the blue comes the question, you know, are you taking, you know, the help of a fertility clinic, or, you know, are you sort of as if, you know, she says that it becomes a little bit of an accusatory question, you know, wherein people kind of brand you as infertile, or, you know, there's a lot of undertone to it. It's not just a casual question that you can ask someone who you don't know very well, you know, and there's a lot of sensitivity that's needed when people approach this subject. So these are all very well explained here in this book.
And what about the other books that you've...
Well, the other book is all fun. As I was telling you the other day, it's a kind of a appropriate book for summer, I would say. You know, if you have a bathtub, and probably if you have a flute. A flute, by the way, is a sort of a glass in which people drink champagne, you know.
Champagne, flute. For a minute, I was wondering why am I
talking about flute? Yeah, that's the American way of calling a glass. a glass tumbler, you know, a flute is probably a lengthier one. So fill it up with a good drink. And
it's very elongated and it resembles a flute. Is that the reason?
It does. I think so. That's why it's called a flute. So you get it filled and then keep it next to your tub and then, you know, just lie down and then open a book and start reading. Or the other way of looking at it, perhaps, is you don't have to change the drink. That can remain the same. But imagine you tied up a hammock at the backyard and then, you know, you just lie down and then, you know, pick up a book and read. That's the kind of a book is the one that I'm talking about, which is The Dating Plan. Okay, The Dating Plan is basically, it's a romantic comedy. And it's good because one is you get reminded of Dilwale, Dulhaniya Le Jayenge, or, you know, nice. Such books where there are Indian characters in a sort of a Western setting. And Daisy Patel is basically, I don't know whether you pronounce it Daisy as in the flower, or Desi, as we call here, because the one the one thing that is for sure is that as Indians we kind of place her exactly in terms of geography. You know that she's a Gujarati.
Exactly. I knew that.
But I guess you know, a lot of other Gujarati traits that we kind of know probably won't fit Daisy, because Daisy is someone who has grown up in the United States, and you know, she has an extended family, and of course inevitably the family has a lot of aunts, and you know what the aunts do.
I know the aunts, they are the
Cupid. They try to play Cupid.
Yes.
Matchmakers, the proverbial matchmakers Cupid. Family. And directly out of Jane Austen's world, only that they kind of populate the Western Indian state. And probably, you know, with that as an ancestry, because in this case, it happens in the United States. So that's,
that's a part of the aunts that they have pervaded even the United States, right?
Absolutely. No, it's funny because you know, there's a cultural divide. You should look at it. The milieu is very interesting, because you know, if it happens in one of those cities like Surat or Ahmedabad or Bombay or, you know, any of these cities, we know, because the society kind of, the backdrop kind of gels with the Indian mentality or the Indian sort of traditions that we discuss in a book like this. But this happens in the United States, where you know, there is a sort of a multitude of cultural presence there, especially the Western Irish, Caucasian, especially Irish, because the male character in this particular book happens to be a guy called Liam, and Liam's family has an Irish ancestry. You know, I was a little sad about that part, because you know how Irish characters are generally portrayed in the Western, fiction, you know. They are the proverbial drunkards, you know. They're the ones who sort of go to all the wakes. You know, they have something called a wake. You know, what's a wake? You know, someone is dead, they'll just keep them in a funeral parlor, and everybody goes to see that dead body. So that's called a wake. I'm going for a wake today. Would mean that you know, they're going to you know, see the dead person. So these are the stereotypes of an Irish or an Italian sort of you know, characters in any kind of fiction, you know, specifically romantic fiction. And I feel Liam and his family is characterized more in terms of, you know, the stereotypical Irish family. Okay, so this is the story. So Daisy has a sort of a crush. You could call it love for Liam. Liam happens to be her brother's friend. And what happens is, like 10 years before the story starts to happen, Liam is supposed to take Daisy for her first proms. But unfortunately, yes.
The prom is a big thing in US.
It's a very big thing, very big thing. Yeah. It's like, you know, you go with your favorite boyfriend. Of course, you're not supposed to sort of do anything more than dance. But I don't know how much lines are maintained. But you know, it's a very, it's a first, what do I say, taste of, you know, romance for a man or a woman, mm-hmm. you know, especially those who are crossing the age of 17. So they go there. He's supposed to take her to the proms, but unfortunately he fails to show up. And then, you know, it sort of leaves a very, very hurt and bitter Daisy. You know, Daisy is basically very hurt and bitter. Although you sometimes wonder whether that's kind of a hurt that a girl will carry for 10 years. But you mm-hmm. won't be surprised if that happens to be an Indian girl. We know that, right? Because our girls are a little more sensitive to such things. You know, we're not...
Not just girls. Even the boys here are sensitive. So, like, they would carry it till the deathbed, I feel.
Yes.
Oh, she just rejected me.
You know, you've been hung out to dry, you know, when this you're supposed to go out with somebody, you know, especially when there's some sparks flying between you and that person. And then, you know, okay. So that being the backstory, Daisy in the present is actually a very, you know, a sort of a brave, she's a techie, a very typical kind of a techie who has this thing for codes, spreadsheets, and organized sort of an algorithmic sort of work schedule, you know.
You can't get more Indian than that.
More, yeah, exactly. You know, and you know, the book begins rather very funnily that she gets into the washroom to pick up this sanitary napkins from the box there. For a session, for a demo session, and then she notices that her ex-boyfriend and her ex-boss, a woman, are necking in the bathroom stall. You know, and
okay,
then you know, yeah, and then you know she's hurt. Naturally, she's hurt because you know. I think, you know, they were both on a rebound. It's not exactly a done and dusted case as far as the boyfriend is concerned. And she walks out and lo and behold, she runs into one of her aunts. And the aunt has a boy in tow, an Indian boy.
I was expecting this. I was expecting her, the aunt, to just take her by the shoulder and see contestant number 1, 2, 3, 4, pick whichever you want.
No, but thankfully, there's just one guy. And then, you know, he's kind of, she says that, you know, this is the right time for you to get married. And then, you know, this guy is around and she wants to just get them off her back. She's desperate. And then she says something, you know, I've got a work to do or something like that. And then she just runs away from the place. And she again bumps into someone. That's Liam. Okay. It's like...
I can already picture the scene.
Yeah, it's like, oh God, you know, the bad thing, you know, one bad thing after the other, you know. So, mm-hmm. but Liam is very surprised and Liam kind of, you know, picks up a conversation. Very awkward, very kind of uncomfortable for both of them. And then, you know, they turn around and see the ex-boss and ex-boyfriend coming. And the aunt coming from the other side. So she wants to avoid both of them. She wants to send a message to both of them. Okay. So she tells Liam that, you know, you pretend as if you are kissing me. Okay. So it's clear to the ex-boyfriend that, you know, she's kind of moved on. Uh-huh. And to the aunt that, you know, somebody is already booked, you know. Yeah. So like kind of, you know, you can't disturb her. And then they kind of get into this pretense, but it starts like a pretense, but it's no longer a pretense. It's kind of a real kiss, although it's not the kind of a romantic kiss that you expect. It's kind of, there's a spark already lying down somewhere there.
So I can already picture Julia Roberts playing this role.
Exactly. When the auntie asks her about it, and even the other two, the ex-boss and the ex-boyfriend, she blurts out saying that, you know, she's engaged to Liam. That's where the whole story starts. You know, that's where the comedy starts. So so from there, it descends into a lot of, surreal, little surreal situations where, you know, she plans out her fake holidays with Liam. And by the way, Liam also kind of have to have a marriage done for himself. Why? Because, there's a grandfather's will that says that, you know, he should be married before his birthday and should be married for at least 1 year to inherit his property. And he wants a perfectly safe marriage where there's no commitment, you know, there's a nuptial agreement and then probably someone who hates him, which makes the job quite easier because, you know, once the year is over, then he can sort of cut off the whole thing and then, you know, take his property or probably offer some to the person who he marries, you know. And so that forces him to Daisy. And Daisy is forced towards him because, you know, she wants to keep the aunties out of, you know, this matchmaking craziness. And also, you know, to sort of give a feeling, give an impression that kind of she's settled or, you know, and make everybody believe that she's settled. So kind of they plan certain holidays, you know. She goes to the spreadsheets and, you know, kind of plans out, you know, where they have to go and stuff like that. Everything is faked out. But, you know, finally, they kind of discover that, you know, it's no longer a fake love, but the real one. And the transformation happens during this process. And the funnier thing is, you know, once this happens, it's not exactly a closure for Liam. There's a little I don't know whether this could be a spoiler, but I'll tell this. Liam is actually a partner of an investment company, and then he's the only non-MBA executive in his company, and so there's something about him that that makes him feel that he's not the most valuable person. He's a little bit of a, you know, he suffers from low self-esteem. That affects their romantic life. And, he has to overcome that finally to sort of come to a full circle, to allow the story to go to come to a full circle. So that's how it goes on. So you know that from the beginning that, you know, these two are going to get married. That's the story. That's the certainty that you would have with any romantic book. But it's how they treat the story that
treat the book, story.
Interesting. And the contrast between the families are very, very exceptional and very nicely portrayed. You know, Daisy's family is all kind of extended, very, very sort of united. They're very nice family. You know, like nice Indian family. You know, Daisy, for example, her aunt tells Daisy that I'm going to meet your father and I'm going to tell him that, you know, it's high time that you should be married off. And, you know, so every time, you know, you come across the aunt, you know that there's some information that's going to your father. So that's a kind of a family that Daisy has. But on the other hand, as I was describing Liam's family, Liam barely kind of gets along with his brother, Brendan. And then, you know, it's a very dysfunctional family. You know, basically, it kind of shapes the characters. She's done a good job, you know. Sarah Desai has done a good job chalking out these characters very nicely for the reader to just have a good and immersive story, you know, experience of a good story. So that's the dating plan for you. And, you know, it's something that people should read absolutely chilled out. Absolutely, absolutely chilled out. And you will enjoy it. It's very funny. It's surreal. It has a little bit of a comedy. Even the, you know, the sex scenes are, you know, sort of comical, you know. So you'll have fun with this one, I guess.
Yeah, I think these are one of the books for, you know, like just to chill is what I'm getting. Have a good time sort of a book. I think what I get is get is that, you know, there are many series out there on various OTT platforms that have like a similar content, but the fact is that you are watching it on screen. So, you know, just to go ahead, why not just read a book, right? It'll just flare up your imagination, and I think that's a good thing.
Better. Yes, always there is this debate. A time-honored a long universal debate that, you know, which one is better? Is the book is better or the blockbuster is better? And of course, everybody without exception have said that, you know, book scores over the blockbuster. You know, whether it's Jaws, Exorcist, even Shawshank Redemption. Anything that you take, because I've read Shawshank Redemption, I tell you, the story. By the way, yeah, I also would like to talk about Breakfast in Tiffany's. I don't know if you've read this Truman Capote's book, and it's a novella basically. And Breakfast at Tiffany's. Breakfast at Tiffany's is basically about. You know, someone who's free, it's about freedom of a woman, you know, woman who's kind of, I think, values her freedom more than the fact that, you know, she has to kind of settle down. And you come across this in many, even, you know, so-called household women, you know, who want to be free, who want to be just having a good time. But unfortunately, they're weighed down by their responsibilities at home. So it's a fantastic story. And that's made into a movie with Audrey Hepburn, and you see that some reviews about the book. You people saying that the book is always better than the movie, so it's always the conclusion. But how do you make people read? I mean, it's something that they have to do on their own, and once they start, they won't give up.
That's for sure. I think with the moment when you said the Breakfast at Tiffany's, the first thing that flashed in my mind was Madhura Tiffany's. I was like, oh God.
Yeah, that's the equivalent of what you find in Bangalore.
Oh, I just flashed like a story in my head, how like if two people had to meet in Madhura Tiffany's having idli and vada together. And
yeah, imagine that, you know, you kind of, someone interests you so much that, you know, that person is very quirky and very irresponsible and very naughty. You know that person is a little dangerous, but still, you know, that danger is what is the attraction. That's the kind of a story that you would read in Breakfast at Tiffany's, by the way.
Nice. So as you know, I was into short stories for a very, very two long weeks. So yes. I had three short stories that you picked out for me. One was The Lottery Ticket by Anton Chekhov. Another was The Boarded Window by Ambrose Bierce. And Horla by Guy de Maupassant. Okay. Maupassant. Sorry, yeah. I'm pronouncing his name every time wrong.
Yeah. No, that's French for you, by the way. Yeah.
French for me, yes.
Yeah. So there's a guy called Guy Fouquet. There's a French tennis player. His name was pronounced as Guy Fouquet. But you write it as Forget.
The Fouquet.
So we always have problem with that, you know. So
I loved all the stories, especially The Lottery Ticket by Chekhov. So this is basically a husband and wife. They are like a usual. Guess what's the name? I'll give you. It's a Russian husband. What is the name of the husband? Can you guess?
Don't tell me it's Chekhov.
No, not Chekhov. But it's a very. You'll immediately say, "Oh God, this is Russian."
It is a Russian. Okay, it's Dmitry.
Ivan Dmitry.
Dmitry, right?
Okay. Dmitry, it is Ivan. His name is Ivan Dmitry.
Okay.
Very, very, very Russian guy. And so this is a Russian couple. They are, reading their newspapers, and there's something about the lottery ticket. So the wife has got the lottery ticket, and they start matching the numbers. And they find that, oh, they are winning something. So immediately both of their minds go like boggling out, like, what will I buy? What will I get? Whom will I save? And it is very funny, like the way the negative thoughts just pierces inside, right? The Anton Chekhov does it beautifully. So the husband is suddenly thinking, I'll buy a plot, I'll save this in a bank, I'll get interest. And then suddenly he's like, my wife will go out spending a lot. And then since it's her lottery ticket, she will have it. Most of the money. What she'll do, she'll try to put in a bank and save. And suddenly all her relatives will come and they'll ask for their share. So the train of thoughts is so seamless. I love it. And then at the end, they discover that, you know, it was some other number and not their number which got the prize. And then it just lays bare the internal insecurities between the two couples. I mean that the way he just seamlessly shows that the thought of trains and how they are having these tensions between each other. It's beautiful. I think what a craft. I was blown away when
I twist at the end.
Yeah, the fact that he doesn't tell that the husband and wife are having some sort of a issue, but then the way he takes the story, right? You get to develop their personalities and remind you, this is it's a short story. So to do that in a very small,
the economy of words. That's the
exactly
specialty of short story writers like Chekhov.
Yeah. And coming to B.S., I was blown away when I read The Horseman in the Sky, but The Boarded Window was like some other level. Yeah. So here he talks about how people are, expanding out in the North American plains and building houses for themselves, and he talks about this one person who was his grandfather's friend or something, who went out and built this house he was staying there with his wife. It was very away from the town, and then this man is found dead in his house. Okay, and then he says we took him and buried him next to his wife. And then he says, no one knew how he died, but he says there's a talk of the town. And then he tells why was the window on his cottage boarded and everything.
Boarded up, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So like just covered and stuff. So what happens is, again, spoiler alert. So what happens is that his wife is dead. Dies because of some reason, and he stays back with her because he can't take her back to the town and then come back every day. So he starts nursing her, and then one day he discovers that this woman has died. And then what he does is, usually in this olden days, they would make a coffin and place the dead body inside the coffin, and dressing up the dead body and then honoring them.
Yes.
So, and what happens is that since he's staying in a jungle, this is a very, very good scene. What happens is the leopard comes through the window and then drags away the body of the woman, but he shoots the leopard. And then there's this very commotion, and then he's very sad about it. And that's how he ends up boarding the window and protecting himself. So,
okay.
That's the mystery, basically. Why is the window boarded?
Where the thing is boarded. Okay.
Yeah. So very, very neatly and very nicely, very beautifully written story. So you couldn't expect, I was the question, why was the window boarded? You don't know. But then this sudden surprise that there was a leopard and everything. I'm like, wow, okay. There's some new twist.
So that's
I never thought of that twist.
Okay.
And then. And then coming to Guy de Maupassant, he talks about is Horla. So here you see this sort of like a talk about. For a second when he says about this wind which is invisible but still has the power to move ships, and that you feel the force of the wind and stuff like that. I'm not yet in the story. I'm just taking a leaf out of the story, and then it's just pushed. The first thing that came to my mind is the coronavirus. We're not seeing it, but we're feeling the force of it. Its impact on the economy, its impact on our lives. I mean, this is something crazy. And then Horla is basically, it's like written as a diary entry of this particular person. It's this French guy. So who thinks that he's possessed, and then he discovers that it may be an alien or it may be a spirit. You can interpret it in various ways, and how he tries to kill that person, and then... it's amazing. It just takes you into a whole new dimension, up, down, left, right, and then it was something if you want, you can't be passive in the story. You have to be active when you're reading the story push your mental faculties give like an acceleration, like a boost to them so that you can, you know, go along with the story. If you don't do that, I think you will kind of fall, sort of lose the track of the story. So
absolutely, yes.
You need to be very active when you're reading Horla. And because he names this sort of invisible creature as Horla. And then he talks about hypnotism. Then he talks about so many other various factors about this spirit and how compares the spirit and himself, the relationship between that of a man and animal, how the animal can be tamed, but it is also dangerous.
Okay, so it typically reminds us of all the natural forces that
and Horla is something comes around as, you know, like he talks about the evolution also in certain ways, because he says, okay, there was animals and we evolved away, civilized, you know, beings into, we're still animals, but there is a man which controls everything, and there is a possibility that there might be something advanced than us, and that might be this Horla.
Right. Right.
So I had really fun picking out these stories and reading them. And they're not too big. Okay, Horla maybe a few more pages, but then the other two are very, very brief and very short.
Brief
you'll enjoy it. Like if it's a hot day outside.
You're kind of almost making me feel a little curious. You're triggering the curiosity in me to go and pick up these three particular stories and read. And I'll probably do that.
Yeah, you should. I recommend the lottery ticket because I love that. Because it was fantastic while reading that. Just because of the pace in which it's written and as you said, the economy of words.
Yes.
Beautiful.
Wonderful.
Russian
writers.
I tell you, Chekhov and Tolstoy, great.
Both their short story collections are great. I agree. Yes.
Yeah.
Far, far superior to anything that you can read.
Yes. And so I think it's been a lot of time that we're discussing this. We have something special for our audience for next week.
Yes. We're going to have a guest with us next week. Her name is Sumaya Khan, and she is a Mount Carmel product, very much a Bangalorean. And she works with an agency concerning health, and an avid reader. And she's here to discuss Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre. And I don't know if you've had an opportunity to read it before.
No, but that's piquing my interest now. Like, let's discover someone new.
Yes, yes. And I think it's more like we should be ready for it than her, because she's already sort of started to talk about the aspects of the book that she might like to discuss. So let's prepare ourselves for it. And I think that also challenges us into reading something of a classic. I'm not very comfortable with classics, but hey, why not? Somebody's challenging me.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna give
I'm telling you, these classics won't leave you.
Yeah,
they're behind you, sir.
Looks like that. Yeah, it looks like the Horla that you've spoken about now, and they're like out and about and always after me. So, I have to get myself ready, and so let's hope to hear a new voice and a new book reading experience. By the way, that's what that we should talk about. We should tell our audience, because book reading, this podcast is more about book readership and book reading rather than about books themselves, because books by themselves are not going to make any sense. But, you know, it's the experience of reading them and, the interpretation, the discussions, the way we the way the books attract us. Those are the discussions that we're supposed to have. And that will inspire others to get interested in books. That's what we do here. And if people are listening to it, what they should do is to write to us, write to you.
Exactly.
AhmadSharif@deccanherald.co.in, and then talk about their fallback book or their favorite companion book that they kind of keep reading all the time, and or anything that they'd like to discuss, any single book they'd like to discuss, and we will put them on our program.
Definitely, definitely. So again, I repeat, Ahmed Sharif at deccanherald.co.in. It is AhmedSharif at deccanherald.co.in. So you can write to us and we will be eager to hear from you.
Wonderful. So thank you, Ahmed. It's been a very long and a very engaging discussion as usual. And
yes.
Let's have, you have a nice reading for the rest of the week. Let's catch up the next week with Sumaya Khan.
Yes, yes, sir. I'm eager to do that episode. Thanks a lot. Thank you. Have a
great
evening.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
That's all in today's episode. Tune in this evening on a news update podcast from the newsroom to catch all the exciting developments of the day and to get the news while it's still budding. For latest news and updates, log on to www.deccanherald.com. Check out our e-paper at www.deccanheraldepaper.com. To read news on the go, sign up to our Telegram channel t.me/deccanheraldnews. Keep up with the news from your interested sphere by downloading the all-new Deccan Herald app, in which you can personalize, have a quick glance at news shots, check highlights, and even listen too. You can get it from Google Play Store and Apple App Store, and you can find the links to the same in the description.